Welcome to Good Areas Live, Wagon Wheel, Manchester, Old Trafford edition, I suppose. I'm in a hotel room on a weird angle. Apologies to everyone for that. If you want to support us or ask a question on the podcast that allows you to do these things, Wagon Wheel. The best way of doing it is by supporting us on a Patreon, which is Good Areas Podcast at Patreon. You can find it there and you can ask questions beforehand. We've also got an AMA if you want to ask private questions, because not everyone wants to ask questions that go available to the public. We have the Discord channel, which is really, really cool. It's the best way to support us if you have the ability. If you are just want to ask the odd question, though, the best way to do that is via YouTube on Super Chats. So we'll get to any Super Chats at the end, but we'll start with our Patreon questions to begin with. He says, oh, doesn't want me to get any. Okay, fine. If that's how you want to be computer. Sanjeet says, I was randomly looking at Scott Boland's stats and he averages 41 in list A with the ball, which seems unconventionally high for that level of bowler. I don't know what to make of it. His first class bowling average is 23 in comparison. Yeah, I mean, I remember Scott Boland from an early point of time never really being a great white ball bowler. It is a bit weird, I suppose, when you compare that with his record in first class cricket and now test cricket, of course, which is very, very different. But yeah, no, I think I was always shocked when Australia picked him to play ODIs because he just didn't really ever seem to have the game for limited overs cricket. My memory is he's also quite expensive. I just brought that up. But if you have a look, also Victoria haven't played him in that many times. So he's played 69 games. I'm trying to think. I don't think he's played for a county, has he? Yeah. So he's played 69 games as well. What's hilarious, though, is he was signed for an IPL team once, but actually, I think eventually people worked out that wasn't really his main skill set. He's a little bit better in T20 cricket, if you're looking for something slightly different from that point of view. But yeah, I don't know what it is about one-day cricket specifically. A lot of those numbers, Sanjeet, I would say, come from probably pre-wobble ball era, when they were trying a bit. He was at Melbourne Stars when I was there, and I always thought that there were ways to use him. But I think he's a very new ball-dependent bowler in white ball cricket. Not a particularly good death bowler, is my memory. And he just doesn't get the wickets that you probably need of a strike bowler in that. But yeah, it's a very different game, and it just probably doesn't suit him as much. Sorry, Abdullah said, why no Kim Upper? Yeah, no Kim Upper, it's only Tuesday. We've got a week. No, we actually did record today, our first ever live podcast together, and we had a guest, which would probably be the second podcast or however you look at it. But we couldn't upload it because we basically recorded it and then Robbie had to go straight to one of his games. So he's got half the recording on his phone. I've got half the recording on my phone. We had actually factored in that at that stage. But we do have an episode, so it will be up. It'll probably just be when Robbie gets back to his hotel room and he can charge things up and do all that sort of stuff. He's probably playing now, is he? Can we do it? Like, can we do a live? Do I have the live scorecards of that league? God, what's that league called? Is it the Masters or something? I was just there. Champions of Champions? I can't find anything here. I'm sure it's up somewhere. I can't see it. But yeah, it's on TV. It's weird, isn't it? Now you can find leagues on TV that you can't find regular scorecards for sometimes. Anyway, these are how these things go. Sam says, for a few seasons, Surrey have put out blast sides with bowling all-rounders who can hit starting at number four with Joverton, Currens, Chris Jordan, Jordan Clark, Nathan Smith, etc., plus Jackson Lawrence. Against Somerset, Ben Foulkes was carded at number nine. From an Evan Goldbliss perspective, how does this signify batting depth or shallowness? And they also have Sibley opening. So I haven't talked to Gareth Batty in a while, but weirdly enough, Sam, I remember when he took over as coach, it must have been, and he was chatting about this, and he was explaining the players that he had available to me, and I think he was looking for the best kind of way of using them. And I was like, if you believe that these guys can bat, why wouldn't you have a batting card that goes down to number eight or nine with five, six, seven specialist bowlers available to you? I'm not sure they're all specialists, of course. You know, some of them are maybe not quite at that level, but quite a few of them are. So why not go with that, which allows your top order to go as hard as possible? You might get yourself in a bit of a bother occasionally because you've got your number four, five, six. What number do you say that? Yeah, starting at four. Four, five, six might be in too early occasionally, but you've still got seven, eight, nine in some of these lineups that he was, you know, talking about doing. And I was like, I don't know how any team could compare with that. The real issue for me as someone from the outside was, they're on the surfaces that do need more specialist batting. Are you leaving yourself a little bit too shallow to be able to do that? And on the other side of that, are you really sure that these are specialist bowlers? Because that's the big thing. Remember, there was an IPL team who reached out to me. God, when was this? 2018, 2019? And they were like, we've been following your template on something that I had done. Not that they'd followed mine, but as in, and it hasn't worked for us. And it was actually probably something to do with it, the all-rounders. And I said, but you don't have five bowlers. You have seven people who can bowl, but you have three bowlers and you have four guys who maybe between them can get through six overs on a good day. Right. And so that was the conversation I had with Bats, is you need to be sure that that is the lineup that you have. And if it is the lineup you have, then, you know, if your top order comes off, it's all gravy. If your top order doesn't come off, as long as those guys, you know, and you look at someone like Sam Curran, who in the blast is probably perfectly capable of chipping the ball around in the middle of overs, right? I'm trying to think who else you had there. You know, those sorts of players, maybe Jordan Clark, someone like that as well. Some available to chip the ball around. And then you have guys from the 14th over in who could come in and whack the ball. It's a really good setup if you can do it. And Surrey were in an incredible position where they could do it. Having money really helps. Aravind says, logically speaking, you would think that counties that traditionally have tough batting wickets would... Counties or countries? Countries, sorry. Why can't I make the speaker today? So weird. And would aid in selecting batters who have better techniques that can handle tough conditions, which would mean that they make runs at any time of pitch. But in reality, it seems to have good batting wickets breeds better batters. Why do you think this is? One is confidence. One of the reasons I think Australian players do so well in general when it comes to batting, and forget all the different advantages that Australia has in sport, but specifically in batting, is that the players that grow up there are more than comfortable with trusting that the ball's going to come on. And so every shot they play, they are assuming that the ball is going to bounce at an appropriate height. It's probably not going to move that much sideways. So they have a confidence to be able to deal with that. If your lived-in experience is the ball jagging sideways, you know, or keeping low, or spinning a lot, or whatever that may, or swinging more, right? There's probably a natural tentativeness built into your batting. So I think that's probably why we see this, Aravind. And most test pitches, certainly what, from the back half of day one through to what, early part of day four, are pretty solid surfaces and they don't move that much. You know, you get less sideways movement in test pitches than you do in first class pitches, right? The only difference you really get in test pitches is you get the decay at the end, which you don't always get in first class cricket. So at that stage, maybe that's when those sorts of players you're talking about would come into their own a little bit more. But throughout the rest of the game, the surfaces are pretty good in test cricket. Even when they're sporting, there's a difference between them being sporty and Darren Stevens being unplayable in county cricket, right? Or, Nikita Miller being unplayable in first-class cricket in the West Indies. Those sorts of pitches are very, very different to what you get in test level generally. So I think that's a big part of it. Confidence, you know, grooving your technique, all these sorts of things, I think, play a part. It's why, I've said this a lot before, I actually think young batters should be playing on synthetic wickets as much as possible, you know, in order to do that. Ian says, when you wrote The Art of Batting, where did you actually start? I assume you don't just start an introduction and write the whole thing in order. And what parts were the easiest, challenging to get down on paper? I did actually write the introduction first, but it wasn't for that reason. It was, I really wanted Bloomsbury to understand what kind of a writer I was and that it wasn't going to be they kind of knew this, but you're never quite sure how much research a company does into you. But I wanted them to know that this was not going to be exactly a standard cricket book, right? It was going to be slightly different in some ways. And so I wrote the WG Grace thing because it was something that had come up to me at one stage of how do I explain what a pioneer is while also sort of explaining why his average is so low and why he doesn't look particularly good if you do find any footage of him. So that was actually the first chapter I wrote. After that, I think it was more just what things did I want to cover. I don't remember what order I wrote the book in. I've got a feeling that the second chapter I wrote is the chapter called Average. I want to say that was the second one I wrote. And that was, again, a little bit for Bloomsbury. So they just knew early on of like, we were going to go a lot deeper than a normal cricket book when it came to thinking about batting and strategy and everything else. And then from then on in, it was probably just brainstorming what the chapters were. So I had a big whiteboard with a photo on it of all the different projects, of all the different chapter ideas. And then, so that's where the book starts. And then I go through until I've kind of nailed each chapter roughly, right? And then I go to the next, but they're not written in order. I went back and I did the order at the end when I was trying to think of the sort of the emotional weight, of each chapter or the importance of each chapter and where I wanted, you know, where I wanted them to flow with the story. And then I wrote the last chapter last as well. So those are the ones that I sort of did. Easiest. I don't know if I think about, I don't know if any of them felt easy. You know, there were some that felt more breathtaking, maybe the chapter on attacking. In fact, the chapter on fast bowling, maybe the chapter on spin as well, but there's another one. The one about Machiavelli and then sort of motivation, right? Those are the ones that I felt from memory flowed really, really well. And then some of the others were a bit, you know, and there was a couple of chapters that I kind of started and didn't think were right for the book. Like I had a whole chapter on how to play seam bowling, not how to play, but, you know, great plays of the moving ball and everything. It just never felt like a really quality chapter. So it might be something that I'll make years later, or it might be something I can go back to if we ever do a reprint of the book. But that was the one thing that I kind of felt that I just didn't think it fit the book. But yeah, most of the things sort of came easy. I'm trying to, there's one or two chapters that I got a little bit caught in. The list chapter was the one that I rewrote the most. That's the one I remember of. I really liked the intro of the list chapter, that I did the list and I didn't like it. And I think that was the last thing we re-edited because I just I wasn't 100% happy with how I'd put it together at that time. Neil says, gutted about Sportsmax shutting down, given how little coverage cricket gets in the West Indies. Any chance you could do something with Fazeer Muhammad? He's a great voice from that part of the world. So Fazeer's one of these incredible people who, it was actually funny, but me and Robbie were talking about this yesterday, how many friends we have in common, and yet me and Robbie had never met before, right? And then, and Fazeer's one of those people who, I don't think I've ever met him. You know, I worked in the IPL, I covered a series in England. In the West Indies. He's covered a bunch of series in the UK. And I don't think I've ever met him. I don't think I've ever sat down and chatted with him or anything. So I don't really have a relationship with him at all. I love what he does. And I would, you know, we have friends in common, I might be able to get his contact somehow. But yeah, I'd love to get him on the podcast and chat to him about his career. I think he's one of the most underrated commentators in the world. I think he's got a fantastic voice. He's got a beautiful ability to phrase something almost perfectly in a TV bite. And he's a very good radio commentator as well. I haven't heard as much of him on the radio, but I've heard enough over the years to be like, oh, this guy's, you know, legit commentator as well. But yeah, I just don't know him. It's not that often that happens because usually you kind of at least bumped into someone, but not in his case. Ellie says, there's a very sizable Bangladesh community in Italy. Yeah, we made a video about that recently. And it's a bit odd that you don't see any Bangladeshi origin players in the Italian team or even English, American, Australian teams in general. Any theories? My guess would be that Bangladeshi community, and I'm not an expert on Bangladeshi communities in Italy, but knowing how it works in England, one of the issues that they had early on was that there was almost like a separation of cricket within the game. So Pakistani kids and Indian kids would quite often play together, but it would be more that they wouldn't always play in club cricket in England. And I wonder if there's a similar kind of thing with Bangladesh. I'm not as aware of it, Ali, to be honest. But yeah, it doesn't really make sense. I would assume, though, not knowing the full history of when Bangladesh immigrated, it might be when they started immigrating to Italy in big numbers. It might be the next generation that sort of does it, because my memory of, like, I grew up with all these Sri Lankan players in Australia, and outside of Dav Watmore, who I think was pretty young when he came over, I don't think there's another Sri Lankan player who plays for Australia from that sort of original generation who comes over. But the generation afterwards, obviously we've got both Agars, I'm missing someone else obvious as well, and we're starting to see a lot of Sri Lankan players coming through in other levels of cricket. I think there's, if I'm not mistaken, the young Victorian opener is Sri Lankan, and there's certainly someone else I'm thinking of that I've spaced on. So it's that sort of generation afterwards, perhaps, that might come through. And some of that can be that the immigrants aren't always in systems, right? Also with Italy, I would guess at this stage that it would almost have to be completely outreaching to get them in the way that perhaps, say, something like the German cricket team did. And I know this for a fact at the moment, that there's huge amounts of Afghanistanis playing in London club cricket. And having conversations with people, they're like, we've already missed out on probably a few good players because they came a bit too late and they haven't quite pushed through. Whereas that next generation of players will be in the system because their cousins and neighbors and whatever are in the system. So it does work a little bit like that. And I have no real idea about how Italy works, other than I know that it's certainly getting its act together as an associate. My guess is it's step by step and they're probably missing out. And I know for a fact that a lot of the associate countries have had trouble with that. If you look at what's happened with Scotland, right? Literally just bringing the immigrant population in to what is an amateur situation, right? So if you're talking about Italy or Scotland, you know, Netherlands probably had a similar one. Those are so amateur that what you need is probably outreach people, maybe someone for already existing from the community and all this sort of stuff. And then you've just got basic levels of, you know, systemic racism, right? And, you know, and the way that those things work as well. Not to say that the people running the cricket are always racist, although obviously we have those issues as well. But sometimes it's just the way that the system is set up, it's not always set up to allow for some of the younger players or some players from immigrant backgrounds or non-traditional cricket backgrounds or traditional cricket backgrounds, but not the ones from that region. So there are lots of issues like that. And, you know, as someone who's been around Scotland, it's something that I think you see quite a bit, and it's probably not going away at all, but it's something that generation over generation, you probably don't fix it. You probably like outreach to one community, and then from on the back of that, maybe you outreach to another community, right? Like, it's probably, would be my guess, is how that sort of stuff works. All right, let's have a break. And then after this break, more of me. I once made a pair in a club game, which is almost impossible to do. But I've been obsessed with batting my entire life. And so I put that into my new book, The Art of Batting. Being that I'm not very good at that skill, I decided to talk to other people who were. So I hit up as many contacts as I could just to talk about batting. Rahul Dravid, Brian Lara, AB de Villiers, Kumar Sangakkara, Ross Taylor, Susie Bates, Nasser Hussain, Ian Chappell, and so many, many, many more. I wanted batters to talk about how they and their friends made runs, because that is the art of batting. You would have thought all the way through that ad break, I would have been like, why don't I find another question? Ben says, if you're the agent of the fifth or sixth best Indian keeper behind Punt, Jarrell, and they really wanted to play Test cricket, would you advise them to immigrate to another Test nation? Financially, I'm sure the IPL alone would be fine, but if they really want Test cricket, moving seems the only action. So there's a really great case of this in the 90s in Australia, where I'm pretty sure Andy Flower tried to get Darren Berry to move to Zimbabwe. I'm pretty sure that's the story. I'd have to go back and check on it. And it was partly what you're talking about, right? Darren Berry was, I think at that stage, he was behind Healy. He was behind Emery. I can't remember if that was the period where Gilchrist was coming along as well, but he knew he was a long way behind. Brian Campbell was coming through the system. Like, they just knew they had many, many options. Brad Haddin actually would have been around at that point too. And Darren Berry, obviously one of the best natural government of all time. And I think he toyed with it. But ultimately, I think he probably thought he could make more money playing cricket for Victoria than he would in Zimbabwe. And that's the bit that you've kind of already answered, Ben. The reason we won't see too many of these, I'm not saying we won't see any, but, you know, we will see the odd Unmuk Chand. And think about him. He went, tried to make it in Australia first and then went to America. I think that's right, isn't it? If it's not right, there was another player I'm thinking of that did that as well. Another, you know, so we will see players like that, but those are the ones who probably don't see any chance to go up. If you're talking about someone who's the sixth best keeper, chances are they're still going to be on an IPL squad and they're still going to be making pretty good money. What changes is what? USA suddenly gets a lot of money. Oman, what's another, you know, Japan, Guyana, I don't know, right? Like, another country gets a lot of money and decides to, you know, invest. That is probably when we might start to see people make a decision when it comes to that. If you're the fifth best Indian wicketkeeper, is there still a chance, though, if the winds get right and you get swept up, you can sort of Graham Manu yourself into a test? So then you have to, I know there was one particular sort of recent Australian player who, one of the reasons he didn't go all in on T20 cricket was just because he wanted to play a test, right? In fact, I think Robbie talked about it on the latest Kamapa that hasn't come out yet, where he, you know, a similar kind of thing with him, where he was like, you know, I changed the way I played because I thought I was a chance of playing Test cricket. So even within T20 cricket or one day cricket, he might still be playing with an eye on Test cricket. I think that tells you how important it is to those players to play and generally for their team, right? So I do think there is an element of that coming through. But yes, let's say you don't care about IPL and you don't care, not that you don't care about money, you don't think you're going to make as much money out of the IPL, and you think it's very unlikely you will get more than one or two tests, and you want to play for 30 or 40 years, have 30 or 40 test matches, then yeah, it would be, you would be better off to move. And isn't that's something we've seen with South Africans already, right? South Africa and New Zealand is already the test case there, Ben. So, you know, what would Neil Wagner have been? He was like the fifth best seam bowler in his domestic lineup, right? Bit of a late bloomer, bit of a weird bowler and everything, and a very late bloomer, really, when you think about when he becomes the bowler that we know him as. So, yeah, I do think you could do that, and I do think people will start to make those sorts of decisions. Sandeep says, some T10 tournaments are stuck in a weird spot, maligned with fixing and other allegations. What are your thoughts on the format in general and its role in cricket, good and bad? I might struggle to come up with good, Sandeep. Good. I'm not against the format. Like, it's a 10-over format. Like, I think it could have some fun. It's weird, though, isn't it? Because it's, I just can't see how it's better than T20. One of the things that's perfect about T20 cricket is 3 hours is a really good time. I know some T20 competitions go for 4 hours, but 3 hours is a really good time. You think about most major sports in the world. This is a really weird one, but I always think that's why men's tennis works better than women's tennis in some ways, is because you have the extra set and you know, there's more narrative that can unfurl, but it's still in a digestible chunk, right? So, you know, I don't know how long the average men's match would go at a Grand Slam, but what, 2 hours and 20 minutes, right? Basketball games, about 2.5 hours would be my guess. You know, so baseball games, American football, rugby, Aussie rules, like, you know, you look at all these different sports. Football's a little bit shorter, so there is an element of that, but football is the final format of that, right? So it can be a little bit shorter, but it's still what, about almost 2 hours. Actually with extra time, it probably is over 2 hours, isn't it? From beginning to end. So T20 cricket's kind of already there. So there's an element of like, why would you need T20 to be shorter? But to get back to your other question, the T10, and I don't want to besmirch every single T10 tournament, but I would say if you ask the ICC at the moment what the main issues were, T10 cricket or T20, they'd be like, T20 is not an issue right at the moment, and T10 is a massive issue. Not to say that there aren't T20 leagues without issues, because there are, but the percentage of T10 leagues that are bad it's actually quite terrifying. And from that perspective, they feel like they're only around for corruption. And that's the worst. And I think we felt like that a few years ago with T20 cricket. So maybe that's just, I don't know, some sort of weird natural evolution of these new leagues and everything. I hope not. But yeah, bad. James says, given an all-time World 11, a time-space travel machine, and a 5-test series to schedule to give this team the ultimate test of diverse conditions and opponents, what time periods and locations are you choosing? Oh, I don't know if this would be fair, but you'd want probably one test from the 1880s, wouldn't you? Probably Australia, because I think the wickets would hold up slightly better than England. Although if it was a wet wicket, good luck to everyone. So you probably have one in Australia in the 1880s. This is just me, James, and maybe no one else would want this. But I would want either one test in Pakistan or South Africa on artificial turf or matting. It would be matting in those days, but which is artificial turf, I suppose. So I'd want one on those. So maybe let's have some fun with it and say 1910s. Let's go 1910 South Africa. We could do that one there. I suppose you would want one test on the WACA. Would probably be the, you know, and what's the peak of WACA? It's either going to be 80s or 90s, or when they had that relayed strip a couple of years ago before they shut it down. Let's go. I don't know, early 80s WACA, late 70s WACA, that sort of period. When would you, it'd be a, my mind almost instantly goes to Chennai. I'm trying to think of what period of time you would want Chennai. Maybe let's go back a little bit further with Chennai and do something around the 60s. Not sure that's fair, but yeah, Chennai is one that I think, because then at this stage you've got uncovered wickets slash pre muck spreading wickets. You have synthetic wicket. You have the fastest wicket in the world. You have a proper turning wicket over generations. Some sort of green basin kind of wicket, maybe one of those ones in the 90s. Would that be a good one for just traditional sort of you're swinging the ball and you're seaming the ball around? I don't think we've got everything covered there. You've got your spin. Your spin gets three different wickets, don't they? Your seamers. Yeah, that doesn't give you a flat wicket, but hey, who cares about batters? Sandeep says, two deeps are injured. If it was you, will you play the remaining deep in the next two tests? Yeah, I'm not worried about another deep being injured, if that's your question. No, look, I wouldn't go in with three spinners. I just don't think they need three spinners. I don't think that's the way to go. But I don't know enough about the bowlers and who's injured and, you know, and who's available and everything. So there might be an element of they might just think Kuldeep could come in. But yeah, no, as I'm looking at the moment, I don't think there's any reason to do that. I just got here. It's quite moist. There should be some moisture in the wicket, right? It's supposed to rain. I just don't know how you fit three spinners into that system. And I'm not sure they need it. So no, I'd probably much prefer to have another seamer, if at all available to me, if there was actually a seamer who was fit and good.
I have travelled the cricketing world, and so I've collected two things: the phone numbers of random taxi drivers and overseas SIM cards. Rideshare apps have fixed the first part, and Sally is doing the second. Now, all you need is their eSIM on whatever plan works for you. You activate it, and you can use it anywhere in the cricketing world. It helps you save money. It is a global solution to a global problem. Stop fiddling with tiny sims and get the one that does it all. Go to Sally.com Good Areas and use the code Good Areas to get an exclusive 15% off your first purchase. Fly free with Sally.
All right, welcome back. And Ben says, with the wobble ball seam being the stock delivery of Test cricket, does an in-swinger or out-swinger become a surprise delivery going forward, especially as people have to face it left? So I don't think it becomes a surprise. And one of the reasons why wobble ball is better than swing is because wobble ball is naturally a surprise. You can't tell which way the ball is going. It's going to come down to you, and you're going to, I suppose these days they mostly play for the ball coming back in. If it goes dead straight, you get the outside part of the bat, but maybe not an edge. And if it moves away, you hope it misses off stump, right? You don't know what's going to happen with the wobble ball though, right? So the thing with swing is you can see swing out of the hand. You can see it in the wrist position, and then you can see it in the air well before. Like in the first 3 meters are the most important thing for any international batter, right? That's when they're getting almost all of their information, yeah? So swing gives you that. Wobble ball in the first 3 meters, you learn nothing other than the length and the line, right? You don't get any other tips. But what I do think will happen is if I don't know how much this is happening in club cricket, but once the wobble ball becomes the predominant ball everywhere in the world, and it may not because we might come up with another delivery or something else might happen. But once it becomes the predominant ball everywhere in the world, how are people going to be as good against swing? That should be a natural movement back towards that. I also believe in T20 cricket that the ability to swing the ball both directions will be very much like wrist spinners able to spin the ball in both directions. And so I think there'll be a natural swing back to swing with that as well. Mob says, I know it's heavily dependent upon having seen the batter in the nets, but as a general rule, what three maxims do you find yourself saying the most while coaching, besides keep your eye on the ball, may relate to any of the cricket disciplines? Okay, so having seen the batter in the net, yeah. I mostly, when I'm working with kids, I haven't really worked with the under 15s yet, so I mostly would be working with under 11s and under 13s. Keep your head still is probably a very big one, right? Of kids want to play the big shot, but their heads are flopping around everywhere. Another one is, and it relates to the head again, which is you're moving your feet, so your head is closer to the ball. So I'm not interested in a big John Cleese step, right? I'm interested in you getting your head as close to the line and length of the ball as you can, so it's you're sort of playing it under you. What would be the third one I would have? Because it is obviously very dependent, Mob, on you know, the kids. The third one's probably your bat's too heavy. My own son did that. He took a bat that I told him was too heavy, and then he used it and he could barely lift it, right? But I would say that's probably the other thing is most kids, and this is, I'm on the parent's side here. It's so hard because if you've got, especially if you've got more than one kid and kids grow, it's really hard to get the right bat at the right time without buying multitudes of bats. And they're selling kids bats for like 150, 200 quid now, right? And parents are buying them and that, so they're buying the heavier, longer one. So that is, and but it doesn't really help stroke play. So what I'm trying to do with the kids is actually encourage them to have the lighter bats early on, even if it's slightly too short for them, just so that they feel comfortable being able to play all the shots and understanding the shots rather than dragging this chunk of wood behind them. So that would probably be the one. With bowling, it's front arm. Like I'm a front arm Nazi, right? Like you want to be bowling, pulling down on that chain in front of you as much as possible. And I want them thinking about that as they come in, because young kids, their arms go off everywhere. And it really has an issue with that. The other one is probably just trying to get them to run in a straight line through the crease. So again, you know, there's a lot that will jump out. They lose all their momentum and everything. They slow down, run through the crease. Don't worry about no balls. We'll worry about no balls later if you get an issue. At the moment, let's just get you running straight towards the target that you're bowling at. Lemon says, Scott Boland has, when he has played, played on helpful wickets, but his match factor is still 1.5. How much of an argument does he have to replace Hazelwood? He has no argument to replace Hazelwood. I've said this before. I don't know why this is even a conversation. Hazelwood has been out bowling Cummins and Stark. Why would you drop Hazelwood in this situation? So no, there's no argument to do that. There's an argument for Boland to come in ahead of Lyon when there's no spinning conditions and you have Bo Webster in the side. I think that's the argument, if you wanted to go down that. If you think there's going to be anything in the wicket for Boland, I think you should bring him in there. I also think that Cummins and Stark should be rested more often, right? And again, Boland should come in for them. Look, he's been absolutely fantastic. The one thing you would say against him at the moment was he didn't like it when England came down the wicket to him. And not enough teams have done that against him. It's not easy to do it against him because he's a big, strong guy and he hits the pitch very much as well. Sinoy says, do you agree world cricket could benefit from India consistently sporting two teams in T20? If a second 11 was to play the likes of Ireland, Zimbabwe, Scotland, Netherlands, would it help elevate their exposure while giving overlooked international Indian players a chance in international cricket? It's an interesting one. It's funny how nothing is ever original, because this is what we said about Australia in the 90s, right? Probably could have said it about West Indies in the 80s. I don't know if we had that sort of thought process in the 80s, but I'm sure someone mentioned it. And they could have. Batting would have been a little bit weak. I think they might have made up for it with their bowling, though. You know, we saw Australia A beat Zimbabwe and England in a quad series, right? And realistically, could have beaten Australia as well. You know, they don't get as much, that Australia A team doesn't get as much credit as Sri Lanka get, rightly, in changing one-day cricket, but they also changed one-day cricket quite a bit, that team. And obviously those players went on to win 3 World Cups as well. Like, you know, there was certainly an element of those players when they came into the national side completely taking over. I don't think you need a second 11. I've said for ages that, and it's probably too late now from a financial point of view, but I always thought that Australia, England, and India should just start a second 11 competition. And they could have played, as you say, the major teams the first 11s of other teams in a proper league and just be playing consistently. I think it's a big missed opportunity. I think it's partly to do with how cricket's always been run. I think it's partly to do with the fact that cricket boards don't always think about these things from the way that a normal sporting league would, but whether it be minor league baseball or the way that football works or the G League and basketball, you know, all these sorts of things. Kind of makes sense to have your players developing in lower levels, but still in stressful environments with crowds and everything else. So, I mean, I don't know if they need to be a second team, but the problem now is with franchise cricket, India's maybe one of the only teams could do it. It's hard for England to, you know, England, this is my understanding of it, and Liam Dawson can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there was a conversation between England and Liam Dawson at one stage about wanting him to come on a tour, but not being able to guarantee that he would play. And he's like, well, why would I give up the SA20 or whatever gig it was? I think it was the SA20 that year. Why would I give that up to come sit on the bench right? And maybe play a test as a backup, which is fair. At the same time, when if he does that, the ownership group and everything else, he might not get the same opportunities, and he's going to be playing T20 cricket, right? Not only is he going to be making money, but he's enjoying it. It's very hard to convince those players to play A cricket when they have T20 franchises available to them now. And I think this kind of a system would also cause a problem. Less so, as I said, for India, but I don't think it can just be India on its own. I do think it probably needs to be a bigger, wider plan. Oh, we're all on the Scott Boland today. Is this the third Scott Boland question? Wow. You take a hat trick and everyone obsesses over you. Worth noting, I haven't done this video yet, but Victorians take a lot of hat tricks. And I don't know why this is, but I absolutely love it. And I believe it's because we are superior to all other people. Raul says, is Scott Boland unlucky that he barely gets a game, or lucky that when he does, it's a favorable conditions alongside a few greats? How good do you think he is? I still think he's limited. I said Sachin was limited recently. People get really upset. And when you're saying someone's limited, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're not great, right? And in the Sachin sort of case of it, what I meant was I don't think Sachin had every single available option to him for every ball in the way that some other batters do. But he was obviously much better at maximizing the skills that he did have, probably to a level only behind Bradman, I would say. And that's one level of greatness. I think if you look at Hazelwood compared to Boland, Hazelwood is probably going to be much more used to you on a flat wicket, and Hazelwood's going to be much more used to you if you need a spell of short pitch bowling, right? Boland doesn't really have a great bouncer. He's not as tall as Hazelwood either. And I'm not sure what his speciality is over Hazelwood, right? But his best ball might be better than Hazelwood's. And so when the conditions are in his favor, you might be seeing, I know someone said before, the match factor is still incredible. Like, he's still 50% better than the other seamers in the games he's in. But you might also be seeing an element of the Stuart McGill record, right? Where he comes in, he's completely fresh. He's raring to go. He's desperate to get another ball. He puts the ball in the right area on a wicket that you assume is going to help him, and it helps him, and he completely cleans up. So maybe there's a little bit of that within his record, because it is going to regress eventually, right? Like, no one thinks he's George Lohman. Is that a good comp? What was George Lohman's average? He's close enough. We'll go. No one thinks he's Sydney Barnes. PJ says, why do national under-19 teams never play any T20 internationals? Wouldn't it make sense to buy? Okay. I don't really know anything about under-19 cricket at all. It's not something I'm interested in, PJ. I couldn't answer this. I just don't know. In fact, I remember seeing this question come up, and I thought to myself, I didn't even know they didn't. I just don't follow T20 cricket, under-19 cricket enough. There was some in Beckenham recently, and I wasn't even in town to be able to go to it. So I missed that as well. I do like going and watching it, but I've never even thought to myself what format is it in. Anil says, what's the scope for scoop writing in cricket, breaking exclusives? Have you not ventured into it because of the limited professional upside? I assume people generally love to read a good newsworthy lead with inside information, not in the public domain. It's not my skill as a journalist, right? I'm very good at investigative journalism over a long period, and I think I'd be a very good journalist at that, and have done quite a few of those big stories. So my last scoop that I'm aware of, unless I've forgotten another one, was the Bangladesh one, the Bangladesh Premier League one. That is a perfect newsworthy scoop for me, right? You know, the Perth Scorchers one a few years ago with the salary cap one, again, another perfect one. That's actually probably more up my alley than most newsbreakers are, than it would be for most newsbreakers, just because it does actually take a lot of extra work. It is more like a feature, to be able to get the full truth of those sorts of situations out. I've done some other stuff as well, stuff that is interesting, but it hasn't really taken off. I think I had a couple of news pieces for The Guardian, maybe have one or two for Crick Info as well. We're talking about in the last 3 or 4 years. I quite often give my scoops to other journalists because I don't always want the scoop to come back to me, right? I don't, if it comes back to me, it might come back to the person who gave it to me, and it's a bit iffy. And as a feature writer, I don't need to be doing that. But yeah, the reason I don't do it is that. So when I worked at Crick Info, if you go back to when I started, me and George start just after him. He is a newsbreaker and I am a feature writer. It would be weird if we were crossing over all the time. If I had a news story that I needed to write and that he wasn't interested in or didn't know enough about, right, I would still write it. But it's very rare that I would have to do that. So when I worked at Crick Info, if I had a news story, it was much more likely to give it to George. Now I probably filter them out a little bit more amongst other people as well. But, you know, I still would, you know, George is certainly someone I would, you know, I might give that sort of information to. There isn't really a situation at the moment. I would say that Boria got himself into a position of being like the Adrian Wojnarowski of cricket. And Adrian Wojnarowski was a very famous NBA writer who didn't really break stories, right? It would be wrong to say that Woj broke stories. What he did was he positioned himself with people of power and then sort of brokered that into, and he did break stories when he was younger, but he brokered that into basically he was the unofficial mouthpiece of teams and agents and coaches and all this sort of stuff. And so he would release the information first. And then there was a guy in the back end that I think was his assistant, Shams's last name is, would be another guy that would have done that. That's a huge business in the American model. In cricket, we don't really have anyone that does anything like that. As I said, Boria is the closest. You've got Chris Barrett, Nick Holt, Dan, and George Dobell that do quite a bit. You have then you have people like KSR and Brettig, who I suppose can write multiple different things. KSR is probably more on the business sort of sides of things. Nagraj is probably more like me in that he will break a story when he has a story, and he does it a bit more than I do. He's much less likely to give it to someone else, I think, than I am. But he probably doesn't break that many stories either, right? Like on a numbers basis. I'm trying to think of anyone else. Telford is probably another one in that sort of style of things. Fidos is probably very similar to that as well. Lawler was probably another one a little bit more like that. So there isn't that much news breaking. And I think part of the reason is that cricket boards are way smaller. You don't, if you think about it, if you're doing Premier League football or an American sport, you've probably got, 30 teams? It's much easier to be able to get that sort of information. Well, we only have 10 major playing nations, and then they're all in different countries. So you're not always going to have connections with them. They might not always even speak the same language as you. So it's nowhere near as easy as it is in the American sports or in football, I think, to be able to do that. They doesn't pay particularly well, right? I mean, I probably get paid better for a news story than I do for a feature, but that's only if the news story is pretty good. In fact, I want to say that I get The Guardian, I gave them a couple, and one of them I think was on the back page, the other one was probably inside the paper. And then the third one they just weren't interested in, right? I thought it was still a decent news story, but it didn't really work. So, yeah, and it's a completely different kind of journalism. So look at all the different facets of journalism I'm already covering. Now I'd have to do that. You basically have to have your phone on all the time. You have to be sending messages all the time. You're constantly stirring a hornet's nest. You also have to have really good relationships. So news writers generally don't burn administrators the way that I burn administrators, because that's where they get a lot of their information from. So it doesn't. There's already too many facets to my writing for me to do it. But it's not a natural state for me. If I get a good story, I will follow it. But I, you know, it's very rare for me to sniff them out. People send me tips all the time, and I quite often try and stand them up. But yeah, it's not in our particular one. I mean, if I would love to find the next newsbreaker and hire them at good areas. But as I said, in cricket, it's a lot more complicated than it is in other sports. And most of the newsbreakers we would have basically only break news about their beats, so their country. So sometimes if you look at George and Brettig, I'm trying to think if anyone else fits into that. But you think of George and Brettig, quite often they will break a story, but it's probably from their contacts, but then it's gone to the ICC. So it becomes an international story, if that makes sense. But it's not as if that their contacts are the international side as much of it, because most of their contacts are going to be on the beats that they cover, which is going to be Australia or England, right? Sanjit says, is the visibility or lack of of a pink ball a reason for it being so hard to play? Why don't they have a white seam like the red ball? White seam just didn't work. I can't remember why, Sanji. I have written about it before. But yeah, no, the white seam didn't work. When they put the black seam on it, people could pick it so much more. I don't know if it's part of the reason. They're weird balls. They swing a lot more. They've got a lot more lacquer on them. They ping around a little bit. They're kind of impossible to play and then easy to play. And I think that's probably the problem with them. They don't have the natural evolution of a red ball. James says, how long do you think Uzi will keep playing Test? Well, I thought he would have been retired by now. So he's already gone longer than I would. So I'm maybe not the best one here. Who'd be you pick for the best current opening partner and for his replacement? I mean, there's no one, right? I think McSweeney has to come back. I think they made a mistake with McSweeney. There's a lot of talk about Weatherald at the moment. I haven't done a deep dive in his recent. I really like him as a professional and as a cricketer. Him and McSweeney. I like that side of them. Whether they're ready to be Test players is probably a different argument. But those are certainly two players that I'd be interested in. I don't know if there's anyone else out there. The rest is probably what makeshift openers, I suppose, or going back to someone like Renshaw, who I don't think's made a lot of runs. Mob says, reports out of Singapore mentioning the final of the WTC being locked in for England for the next three iterations, as well as a two-tier World Test Championship format of Six Nations starting with the next cycle. Casting your mind ahead to the World Test Championship final of 2023, where do you think those finals will be held, bearing in mind that they're now two divisions requiring a final? So one of the reasons that it's happening in England, there's a bunch of reasons why it's happening in England, and me and Will McPherson were going to do a podcast on the reasons this keeps happening. One is that England really want it, right? And the way that we've scheduled these tournaments means that there aren't that many times of the year that you can play in. So there aren't that many other places in the world that can hold them. They don't want to play it in somewhere like the West Indies or Sri Lanka because they're worried about whether people will turn up and whether there'll be any interest. Is it India at this time of year is the rainy season? Is that someone told me that? I'd have to go back and check my notes on that. I was trying to do a piece on it. You obviously can't play in Australia. You obviously can't play in New Zealand. You pretty much can't play in South Africa. You can play in Australia and South Africa if you were to play up, you know, in certain parts of the country, but whether that again would get crowds is another one. It is a bit awkward that we keep playing it in England, but it's not like the early ODI World Cups where it was a little bit more, it's England, of course we'll have the World Cup here. I know there are a lot of fans who see it that way. I can promise you it's not that, because I've had people from boards who are just like, yeah, we don't want it. So yeah, it is a little bit awkward and everything else. I think Pakistan would be a place that perhaps you could play it in, but then if India make the final, they can't hold it anyway. They don't want to play it in the UAE. But yeah, eventually we have to get beyond that. But yeah, answering your following question, I think they'll just have to be more flexible of when the final is. But the problem with that is if they're more flexible when the final is there an element then of you've already started the next cycle and you haven't played the final from the last one? That's where it gets a little bit icky. But yeah, I'd have to go back through all my notes on that, Mob. I don't remember them all off the top of my head. Hopefully I got a few over there. Lemon says, which current bowler in the world has the highest peak spell? Is it still Bumrah or is it someone like Stark when he's in rhythm? I would have thought it's Bumrah or Rabada. I suppose Stark fully in rhythm. He's been in good rhythm for a little while now. I still don't completely buy him. Yeah, I think I would probably have Bumrah and Rabada would be the two best picks I would have thought for that. Sinoy says, hypothetical and a completely unfeasible idea. Love it. But if given an unlimited budget, thoughts on creating a Champions League style setup, but for first class cricket instead, do it as a straight knockout format. Yeah, I think if you're going to do that, I just don't think you'd make any money from it. Like, I just don't think there's an audience for that kind of thing. So that you wouldn't do it, but hypothetically it would be a great idea. I think I'd prefer though to go back to what we said before and have the development league. I think if we had I think I might have said this recently, if we had like a second division of Test cricket, I'm probably much more likely to follow that than the first division. And if we had a second 11 kind of thing going on, I'm probably even more likely to go that. So for me, that's fine. But yeah, I just can't see how you would ever have the ability to. No one would go. I just don't think it would work. I love the idea of it. there's nothing wrong with what you're saying. It would work. I don't know why you put South Australia in there, though. They would definitely not be in that. PJ says, is sports media the biggest cancer there is in cricket media? And sports media in general, if every news is considered breaking news, is there really any breaking news to begin with? Look, I see sports media as an aggregator, right? And they're not on their own. They don't really produce anything of quality. They're just SEO farms, right? And there's heaps of them. This is not a cricket-wide specific thing. It is a problem for cricket more generally because it is very hard to compete with the SEO farms because when you try and get funding or advertising, they're like, oh, but this SportsKita, look at their millions. And I was like, yeah, but the average person on their website is like a millisecond, right? Because you click on and you click straight back off again, right? Then they don't have an audience. They don't have a fan group. They haven't built any trust within any community. But as I said, this is a thing right across sport now. I would assume it's in football. I've certainly seen it in American sports. In some ways, I actually think cricket might have been maybe not ahead of the game here, but certainly we're right there at the forefront on this one. Maybe not the one you want to be ahead of, but hey, you can't always pick what you're successful at. But yeah, so. It is an issue. It's been an issue for a very long time. I think that's fair. I don't want to have a go at SportsKita over any of the others because they all do it, right? There are hundreds of them. Right? I remember being at ESPN when ESPN did this. They came in and they said, well, this website's got this many views and, you know, CricInfo is this big, but it doesn't get that many compared to this website. And I was like, yeah, but that's junk. There are people who die for CricInfo, right? There are fans who just absolutely love it. I met someone recently, like, a random guy at a party asked me what I did, told him I worked at cricket. He was like, oh, I love CricInfo. It's my favorite thing ever. Have you ever worked for them? I told him I had. I thought he was going to cry, right? No one fucking doing that for Cricket Addict, right? Or SportsKita, right? Or First Post, or some of those places, right? They're just not. Doesn't mean that occasionally great work doesn't come from there. Doesn't mean that really talented people don't come from there. Did Cheyenne work for SportsKita? I can't remember, but Cheyenne worked for one of those kinds of websites, right? Very possible that great people can come from there. But those things, they are, you know, it's just the way that it works. I wonder what the future of Google is. Like, as in, if we all move to searching things via Twitter and TikTok and Instagram and ChatGPT, right? Do those things just die a natural death, or do they work out how to translate into social media stuff? Some of them are already very good at social media stuff, right? Maybe that's the next step. It's not going away, though. That isn't the problem with cricket media. The problem with cricket media is that there is not enough money in it. It is not developed correctly. People have not maximized it because CricInfo hasn't made money for many various reasons when it should have made money. I think that's caused lots of issues. I think the international nature of cricket makes it trickier than other sports. You know, we can go through. The aggregator sites are an issue, but they're not the issue with why cricket media isn't as good as it should be. It just isn't. I just don't believe that's the case. All right. That is it with the Patreon messages. So we'll have a quick break here, and then we will come back after that with more of me saying things.
Brian Lara used pot plants to work on his placement. John Wright glued his glove to his bat. Sachin Tendulkar dug up practice pitches. Tatenda Taibu cut the top off his bat. Claire Taylor used a hockey grip. Steve Smith was from tennis. Dean Jones would call phantom runs. And Victor Trumper turned the Nets into a war zone to survive. The best batters in the world do whatever they have to make runs. We have told their stories in our new book, The Art of Batting.
Welcome back, and we've got some super chats. Where is he here? Ayant says, who's on your men's cricket Mount Rushmore? That's a really good question because I've never thought about this before. I'd go Grace, Bradman, Sobers, Sachin. Want a bowler too, ideally, but couldn't drop anyone here. Depends what you mean. If you were just going best five cricketers of all time, I think you would have Bradman, Sobers, Callis, Khan in the top four. So that gives you Sachin, who you don't have, who you have as your potential fifth. You could have, trying to think of someone else, probably not quite Keith Miller, is it? I don't think there's another all-rounder because I don't think both of them's quite at that level. So then you can have Sachin. Then you can pick one out of Sachin, Murali, Sid Barnes and Warne, I suppose, depending on how you want to go. So my list gives you Imran Khan as your specialist bowler, if you want to go in that direction. And then I wouldn't have Grace if it's Test cricket or if it's international cricket. If it's impact on cricket overall, then obviously Grace comes back in. But then if you're doing that, then if you're factoring in limited overs cricket, then obviously Sachin comes up. And I don't know if you still have Imran Khan or Callis in. Then does Wasim Akram come up? Perhaps. I don't know if he's batting quite at that level. Sean Pollock come up? Yeah, I don't know. But it's a fascinating question. I've never really thought about it before. Glad you didn't. And I'm now thinking what my women's one would be, but don't ask me that, anyone. Samit says, watching Under-20 Rugby World Cup, saw Springboks Riley Norton, who also played Under-20 cricket for the Proteas. Are there other similar dual sports cases in men's and women's cricket? Is pro sport killing multi-sport careers? Yeah, definitely. Pro sport is killing it. It's really hard to do that now. Well done to, what was his name? No, I lost it. Riley, for doing that. Yeah, who do you want? Susie Bates represented New Zealand in women's basketball and obviously then went on to play cricket. She played against the Americans. It's in my book. I interviewed her about it. In fact, she's done a podcast. You can find it on the live channel. All right. Elise Perry played football and cricket for Australia at World Cups. She scored the goal of the World Cup. You've got a bunch of cricketers who played professional football. I suppose what Dennis Compton and Ian Botham would be two of the more famous ones off the top of my head. You've got a bunch of people who play rugby and cricket. Isn't it Namibia? They certainly have someone who's done both. There is a New Zealand player whose name is it Mark Burgess? All right. We're going deep here. Mark Burgess. Let's have a look. Did he play football? I think Mark Burgess played football for New Zealand. And maybe I'm misremembering, but if it's not him, it's someone. There was definitely a New Zealand cricketer who played football and cricket for the nation. There's a whole plethora of Aussie rules versions, which is in cricket. So Alex Carey obviously was a professional footballer. Shane Warne, I don't know if you'd call Shane Warne a professional footballer, but he was. But he played one reserves game, so second 11, I suppose you would say, for St Kilda. Simon O'Donnell played for St Kilda and played cricket for Australia. I'm missing another. Jamie Siddons played professional football and obviously was an incredible cricketer as well. Max Walker, I think, did both. Keith Miller did both. Keith Miller was also a jockey, so I'm pretty sure I'm saying right in saying that Keith Miller was a professional athlete in three sports. Yeah, now I'm trying to think of something. There's heaps. So I always get this question, and there's so many. There's a bunch in women's sport as well, and I've got the list somewhere because I've had to go through it a few times before. Depending on whether you count indoor cricket as well, there's quite a few people who played indoor cricket. So, yeah, it definitely happened a lot more in the old days, you know, Aussie rules football and professional and soccer football are both kind of made to be sports to keep the athletes fit for cricket, right? There's a bit of a debate with that, but in some ways they were formula. It was certainly Aussie rules football was almost directly done with that, but there's an element that is what the early sort of football was as well. So there was a reason to play both, right? Ash Barty is another one who obviously she went the other way. But there are loads, but yes, I do think in the future, I mean, I can't believe Riley's done it. I think that just tells you, you're a freak athlete if you can do it now. It's a shame because it is one of the cooler things, I think, when we see that. Ayant says, in your all time great 11, who'd be your bowlers? I'd go Imran, Marshall, Warne, McGrath, Sobers. Barnes is a good shout and Bumrah may get there eventually. Imran, Marshall, Warne, McGrath, Sobers. It's pretty good, isn't it? I don't think my list would be massively different. There's an argument for Bumrah coming in for Marshall because you already have new ball, but you already have old. Well, you've got new ball bowling with Warne, with McGrath and Sobers, a little bit from Imran, but then you've got old ball bowling. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I mean, Again, that's something I'd have to spend a long that and the Mount Rushmore. I can't really answer that now just because it would take too much. But I don't have big issues with your lineup. I'm trying to think if you can make it better. No, it's pretty good. It's a pretty good lineup, that one. Ayo says, from Canada, no question, just love your content. I hope you keep on making more of these. Any big updates in the pipeline? No real big updates. The thing, we'll certainly be making content for the next 6 to 9 months at the level that we are. We won't, I don't think I'd ever stop making content here. But things might have to change if we can't get a key sponsor in or we can't get enough, you know, regular sponsorship money coming through. So that might change what we do and how we do it. We want to go back to doing more of the video essay. So we have a video essay at the moment, but they are quite time consuming and tough. Saurabh Saman is going to start doing some more writing for us, which will allow me to sort of be more the director role, which is kind of what we want to get to as well. So I suppose that will change a little bit. Me and Robbie want to do more stuff. I hopefully go on tour together and do things like that, go to major events together. But yeah, there's until we get the sponsors, we're sort of stuck where we are at the moment, which is not a bad place to be at all. And, you know, we love, it's great, but I would like to get to the position, you know, further on where I can set up a proper cricket podcast network, right? You know, have experts talking in every place, make them make good area videos for us when they want to. So have, you know, I have access to all the you know, some of the greatest minds of cricket to be able to work with. I'd like to be able to get us to a point where we're not fully dependent on YouTube. So that, you know, we maybe even can make documentary projects where we can sell them and put them up on our YouTube channel, and do things like that. All those sorts of things. But yeah, there's no sort of big change in the short term. We're still looking for investment in the company where, you know, I've been talking to investors, I've been talking to sponsors. I'm kind of stuck a little bit in the middle at the moment. But yeah, that's where we are right now. Reese says, hey, Jared, thank you for your footmarks episode 100. It moved me massively. What would you say is your favorite thing about club cricket in the UK? Oh, well, thank you very much for that comment. If you haven't gone and seen it, it's worth having a look at. It talks about my journey in quite big detail of getting here. My favorite thing about club cricket in the UK? So me and Higo and Sam did a podcast for TalkSport recently, you know, talking about great cricketer. There is an element of, I don't know how to fully explain this, but me, Higo and Sam all kind of felt that at times there was a lot of people who played cricket in Australia to chase some sort of form of glory. And it's like, they actually hated the game more than loved it. I don't feel that as much in the UK. And maybe it's because people don't sign up to play every single game all the time and make themselves available and everything. They don't take it like it's a test match. I found there's a lot more joy in playing cricket in the UK than I found in Australia. The level of cricket was different in Australia, and there are some things I loved about Australian cricket that frustrate me about English cricket. But that I have found that there is a lot more joy and that the individual games are more enjoyable to me than they were probably when I played in Australia. So I'd say that's probably my favorite thing. I would say that. The other thing is that there's something awesome about the fact that Australian cricket grounds are so open and they're run by the councils. And, you know, you can always see cricket in Australia. But English cricket grounds, they're just so often you just turn up at a ground and just take your breath away. And that was not the case when I was playing in the north and western suburbs of Melbourne, where the vast majority of the grounds were ugly as hell. And you had like a factory coming over the back of it or whatever. So yeah, I'd say that's probably a lot different. Shrikant says, did fast men pre-Lilly bowl within themselves tactically to save energy, avoid injuries? Saw this with Limor in the late stages of 53. Yeah, I mean, they still do. Shrikant, I would say they did after Lilly. The big change, and this is according to Darren Goff, Alex Shooter, I haven't talked to some of the other bowlers, but the big change was the speed gun. Suddenly, if you were down on speed and you didn't take wickets, everyone thought that was you were injured or you weren't trying very hard. Whereas beforehand, people couldn't tell if you were down on speed, right? Like most cricket writers were unsure and they wouldn't always go in with it unless it was really, really obvious. So we didn't always see our fast bowlers at maximum. And if you go back and you read the anecdotal evidence, like I mean, there's a podcast I do on this with Ellie Studer, which is, it's a fascinating one if you haven't listened to it. And I think it's called something like The Tyranny of the Speed Gun or something like that, right? And why it's fascinating is what used to happen was you bowl your opening spell, you bowl your second spell, right? So let's say you're bowling to the condition. So you're either bowling as fast as you can or trying to swing it as much or whatever that may be. Your third spell, you might come on and just be like, and the captain might be like, just hold them. We just want to hold them for a little while here. Then your fourth spell, the captain might be like, I need the gut buster. I need the big spell here. I need a breakthrough. I really need you to try really hard, right? So that meant that when you got to your fourth spell, you weren't killed because your third spell wasn't as big, right? It feels that we have moved towards, and in many ways, a good thing that bowlers are always bowling at their maximums, but whether we can do that physically, right? That's the big question, and that's the one that is really hard to answer, I suppose, going ahead. But it's, bowlers have always bowled within themselves, and I don't think we see as much now as we have previously. I still think we see spells like that, though. I think there is an element of that, but it's not like it used to be. Jack says, if you were Boland, is this our fourth Boland? Can you quadruple Boland? Apparently you can. How would you keep yourself motivated? And how would you keep resentment away? Because I imagine it would get tiring after a while. What would you need from your coach and your captain? I don't think this is how Boland works. I think this is more a question for if you or I were Boland, because I don't think this is how Boland works. I don't know him particularly well, but we have some friends in common. Everyone said he just can't believe he's got this opportunity and he's so happy. He knows it's going to be very hard to break into that trio, right? He's taking his opportunities every single time. You know, look, we've all been in situations in life that there are very few Sachin Tendulkars and Tom Cruises, right? There are very few people who just are number one billing from the day they start to the day they finish. Most people have to deal with the fact that there is going to be a bigger monster, right? There is going to be a richer person. There is going to be a better looking person, whatever that may be around the corner. So we all practice for being Boland all the time. You say how I'm going to be motivated. Well, my motivation is to come back in and prove that I should be in the side all the time, right? My motivation is if one of these guys is done, it's my job. And I am going to show you that I'm absolutely ready. Players who start playing at Boland's age quite often are disposable. He's doing the Mike Hussey. You cannot dispose of him. Right? Most Mike Hussey type players end up more like Adam Voges or Simon Kadic, right? They're there while they're in absolute best form. And the minute they're not in absolute best form, they're disposable. Oh, gone. How do you do that with Boland, right? If I'm Boland, I'm just reading up on Colin Miller's career and be like, that is not going to happen to me. I'm going to make sure that I'm fit and available whenever they need me and going to be at the top of my game. Shrikant says, Why is yardstick for greatness peak impact at the highest level versus sustained durability at one level below? Wilfred Rhodes, Freeman versus Bumrah and Marshall. It's not, though, is it? It depends on what you believe, Shrikant. This is why people get so angry. And, like, you know, one of the reasons I have Sachin so high in my list is because of the ability to do what he did for as long as he did, right? Which means his team does not have to replace him for generations, three generations, right? That's incredible. And so that means to me that let's say he was, I don't know, and I'm not saying he isn't, but let's say he was, I don't know, 3% worse than Lara or Ponting, right? And he plays for 8 years longer. Who's the best player? Well, in my mind, it's generally going to be Sachin in that situation. There are situations where that isn't the case, when maybe they've had more similar careers or maybe for what, like, if you look at the Steyn and Anderson one, you could argue that maybe Steyn was at 90, sorry, you know, let's say that Steyn was at 97% and Anderson was at 85% and then 100%. I'm just making these numbers up, right? But for 10 years and 10 years. In that case, you probably want Steyn at 97% for 15 years over the extra 6 years from Anderson. But you can still make the conversation, right? Because what Anderson did, it gives you this extra ability. And so if greatness depends on you, if you're just doing peak, was it Peter? Here we go. Here's a fun one. If you were just doing peak, like, where does Jimmy Adams come? Right? Like, he had an incredible peak. Peter May, see if I can find Peter May's numbers here. Peter May for 5 years. So from 1955 until 1959, averaged 54, 67, 47, 55, 59, right? Didn't make my list. It's a really good peak. But he had, all things considered for a great player, quite a short career. Didn't make runs away from home. If I was just doing peak, I'd be like, this guy's incredible, but I'm not just doing peak, right? And so it's up to you what you think greatness is, Srikant, right? And you can set your own terms. People are going to disagree with you because it's a subjective measure. Harshit says, can the 50-50 come back as bowler-friendly tournament? Can the 50-over tournament come back as a bowler-friendly tournament? Is that what he means? You'd have to change the balls. If your question is 50-over cricket going to make a comeback, can it come back as bowler-friendly? So I always thought that once T20 cricket came, the smarter thing to do would be to get rid of the 5-bowler limit in ODI cricket to make it very different and allow you to have 4 bowlers who can bowl 12 overs each, and then your 5th over is your part-time, a bit more structured like test cricket, but it's still not test cricket, right? The problem with that now is I think trying to get the best players in the world to bowl an extra 2 overs a game might not work. It's just still could argue it. I think they did it in domestic cricket in Australia, and you can have 2 bowlers bowl 13 and 2 bowlers bowl 12 or something like that. I'd have to go back and check the numbers. Maybe it wasn't that, but it was around that. So it has been changed. I just think that's very tough now. But yeah, if you want it, it would just have to be, the ball would have to be better, and that isn't going to happen. Jack says, if you're carving Rushmore, would you consider purely on skill or how they were as people too? For example, would you have someone like W.G. Grace on? I remember you saying he was not a pleasant person. Didn't George Washington have his slave's teeth in his mouth? Was that right? If I'm probably doing... It's a tricky one, isn't it? There are probably... You could make arguments for Subers, Imran Khan, Shane Warne, Grace, I'm trying to think of who else we had on that list, to not be on the Rushmore based on various different aspects of their personalities, depending on what you like and what you don't like. You know, you might not want a politician on it in Ryan Khan's case, right? Like, perfectly acceptable. I don't know if that's how I look at things. I remember being contacted by someone when the Rachel Hayhoe Flint gates were coming up. And then this person was a black cricket person in the media. And he said, I see you're on the side of Rachel Hayhoe Flint Gates. You know what her relationship was with apartheid. And I said, yep, no, I understand all that. But also know that W.G. Grace is also a very problematic person and that there are pictures of people still in Lords who are very problematic people for many different reasons, right? There are people on the wrong side of Basil de Oliveira that are still, you know, have paintings and things and you know, are remembered as legends through at Lords, and not just at Lords, at other cricket grounds as well. I know there's a big thing in America with the Hall of Fame. I think this is a baseball thing, if I'm not mistaken, where they take a lot of character. They take a lot of the character of the person into it. I understand that, and I understand why you would end up on that. But we are not actually making character judgments on these people. We are making judgments on how good they are at cricket. I don't mind Grace having gates at Lords as long as we give him his full context. He wasn't a particularly good person. He didn't think women should play cricket. He did speak down about lots of different about professionals. He was a shamateur, right? Like, he probably was involved in some forms of fixing, even if they were small games and not major games or whatever. Like, all these sorts of things with Grace, I think, are definitely on the table. The same with Rachel Hayhoe Flint. Everything great she did for women's cricket, she gave a lot of it back morally when it comes to wanting to host a World Cup in South Africa in the 70s. And not only that, basically trying to get a de facto South African team into the World Cup under the guise of an international 11 or whatever she called her team. But that is our past, right? And as long as we don't do... When I came into cricket, I always felt that like Grace was seen as this cheeky chappy. And I think that's the wrong way of looking at it. I think we have to be honest and say, this is a man who really changed cricket and was incredibly important to our sport, but also probably not a good dude, right? Rachel Hayhoe Flint did incredible things, and women's cricket wouldn't be where it was right now if it was not for Rachel Hayhoe Flint. But she had problematic views when it came to apartheid. right? I think that's the better way of speaking about it. I've talked about this before with the South African. I don't like the fact that the players before readmission are not considered South African players by Cricket South Africa. I just think that's the wrong way of looking at sport. We should be looking at it from the other way. There's a player, in fact, I'm waiting to have a conversation with a former player about something that I wrote in the Art of Batting, because I know they won't be happy with this. And I know they won't be happy with it because they think this person is a horrible person and doesn't deserve to be spoken about highly. And I have spoken about this person highly, while being, I think, quite clear in there with some other things. But I think that's the way to do it. I really do. I think that's the better way of doing it. I don't like pretending that people didn't exist because they were problematic. I would rather us talk about the strengths and weaknesses of people within our sport morally rather than just not mention them anymore and move on from them. So the real question I would have here, Jack, is I actually don't know that much about Mount Rushmore. Like, I don't know what if I was doing it, I'd be looking at it from a logistics point of view of what is Mount Rushmore trying to be? What gets you on Mount Rushmore? My guess is it probably isn't your interpersonal skills or your how good a person you were. I think we could, I don't know all the people on there, but I think we could probably make some claims that not everyone there is absolutely perfect as human beings. But that's probably not why they're on there. If you're really doing a Mount Rushmore of cricket, I would say that grace, and we're talking about the impact, if we're talking about players who had an impact on the sport, Grace and Rachel Hayhoe Flint would have to be up there. You probably think that Bradman and Sachin and Imran are probably the other three that have to be up there. I think that's unfair on Sobers, but I don't know if he had quite the same importance to cricket as great as he was. But I'm talking about people who probably changed the profile and the direction of the sport for every reason. Harmanpreet would not be far from being on there in some ways, right? Like, people have legitimately changed the sport if you're looking at it from that point of view, or you just have the five greatest players of all time, right? So I don't even know where you go with that. Shrikant says, Sobers versus Callis doesn't often bake in the fact that Sobers bowled a lot more overs per match. Does when I do the research, Shrikant. How would Callis fared as a sole strike bowler? It's incredible how many overs a game that Sobers bowled, especially considering he wasn't always thought of as a frontline bowler. It really is. There's a certain point of his career where he goes from sort of a fifth bowler to like a second bowler, and we've never seen anyone do that before. I just don't think Callis could have done that. I think he would have had to change who he was as a cricketer. That's not a slight on Callis, because I think Callis was used better than Sobers. I think if you had Sobers now, you would probably bowl him for two early spells with a new ball and then just say, we will use you after the 100th over if we need you again, right? Like, why? He was just so overused. Maybe you get him to bowl one spell of spin between overs 50 and 80 if you had to, of like five or six overs. But yeah, I think you would use him very differently. But no, absolutely no doubt that Sobers was just, Sobers was a frontline bowler and a frontline batter, and he probably has a worse bowling average he definitely has a worse bowling average than Callis for two reasons. One is match factor, because the pitches he played on were not particularly conducive to taking wickets, and the other one is that they just continually gave him the ball as like the magic man. Wait, did I get that one? Yeah, that was Shrikant. And Ed says, why so much talk about Bashir and his form when he has taken more wickets than both Sundar and Jadeja combined this series? Those two guys can both bat at number 5, 6, 7 or 8, Ed. They're not particularly similar. I'm going to assume also that averages play a small part to play. Jadeja can also, I think I was right in saying this, that his economy rate is being pretty good. He's had a couple of times when he's gone, but he can stop the runs. The Bashir can't stop the runs, really struggles with economy rate. And Washington's had one incredible spell where he almost set up the win for them. But a lot of it isn't, it's just, I mean, if you just look at more wickets, let's just have a look at this statistically for a moment, because I think that's fascinating. If you just look at more wickets, that's obviously not how we look at bowlers, right? Like, it's a lot deeper than that. Where are we, stats here? Okay. So most wickets in the series. So Bashir has 10 wickets in three games and an average of 54. Jadeja has 3 wickets and an average of 110, but can bat at 7, right? I don't think many people have said he's bowled well, but that's fine. And Washington has 5 wickets at an average of 28, right? So the first thing that you're going to notice there is that Washington has done his job. So let's take him out of that equation. He's bowled fantastically. He's been the best spinner in the series by a distance. So he's fine, and he can give you runs. Bashir, again, can't do that. Let's just go on Jadeja. So Jadeja, I think he's bowled. There was one I thought the game at Edgbaston, I thought he bowled magnificently and just didn't get a wicket in that second innings. But he's bowled against England, and he's going at 3.34 runs and over against the Baz bowling team. Against India, who have been a lot more defensive outside of Rishabh Pant, Bashir's gone at half a run more and over. He can't control an end. He's not particularly playing as a strike bowler. He's not a particularly good fielder, and he can't bat. The other guys can field and can bat, right? But I think what you're getting stuck here with is literally counting stats, right? So if we just go back, sorry, now I've obviously clicked away from it like an idiot. If we look at counting stats, he's bowled 140 overs, and the other two have bowled 140 overs, and they have 8 wickets while also lengthening the batting lineup and being far more economical. Even Washington's far more economical than Bashir has been. Also, 1-4 wicket haul between them. If you were combining that into one player, you would still pick the Indian one any day of the week. The question with Bashir really isn't about this series in general, though. The question about Bashir is really, does he have the ability against the best players in the world to either be consistently probing or to take wickets or to add in any other way in the game? And he doesn't, right? Like, he just doesn't. He's not ready for this. And England are trying to get him to Australia so that they have a off-spinner who can bowl for them in Australia. There are games when they're going into the match with 10 players because Bashir is just not going to be of any general use to them. He's not a test-quality spinner. There's no time I've been looking at Jadeja or Washington Sundar in this series and being like, they're not test-quality spinners. And so it isn't just about the amount of wickets. It's about everything, right? And I like Bashir's spirit and I like his work ethic. I don't want to say he'll never be a successful test bowler because his best ball is fantastic. I think he has some biomechanical issues with his bowling. I think he's maybe starting to fix some of those. And I think he could learn and develop to become a cricketer. But he's not an international quality test spinner right at the moment. And I don't know anyone who really believes he is. Even, I think, if you talk to England behind closed doors, I don't think they would say he is. They would probably say, but he's tall, but he can bowl quite fast, but he might be handy in Australia and everything else. That's where we are with him. That's why he's being mentioned so much. That's it for me. You've all got me through to dinner perfectly. A lot of super chats there at the end. So thank you to everyone who super chatted. Thank you to everyone who just chatted. Just so you know, on your way out, subscribe, like, comment. All those things actually help us for the algorithm and everything else. Thank you to everyone. There's so many people that were here on this live today. As I said, for those who missed it, the Kimapa podcast will come. We're just waiting to get the stuff off Robbie's. It will probably be split up into a couple of shows, as you will see why during when you actually see those. But yeah, it's not. We couldn't do it live this week because we were doing it in a hotel suite in Birmingham, and it was just easier to do it the way that we did, and there were lots of, just to make sure that the technical stuff. But I can also tell all Kimapa fans this. One day I'm going to go home at the end of this test match, and I have working internet. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes.
Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.